we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program focusing on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is CFRO 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. Today is Friday, August 11th, 2017. For the next hour, I'm your host, Jen Dobell, and I'm joined in studio by my animal-loving vegan co-host, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
Jillian Walters.
Hey.
And Amir.
Hey.
On today's show, we will focus on the animals who are the innocent prisoners on zoos and aquaria around the world. In news this week, animal cruelty charges were dropped by the Crown against marine land in Niagara Falls. We will speak with animal rights lawyer Anna Pippis about the case, and we also have a feature interview with Canadian photojournalist Joanne MacArthur, who documented the lives of animals in zoos and aquarium settings in her latest book, Captive. Stay tuned for those interviews in the next hour. And first, we want to tell you about the National Animal Rights Conference that Allison and I attended last week.
And we're still recovering from, right?
Yes, we were.
Both of us got sick.
5.5 hours of sleep every night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely got sick on the plane on the way back.
Well, it was worth it, wasn't it? Let's talk about our highlights.
Yeah, highlights. Well, it was your very first time attending the National Animal Rights Conference, Jen. I think this is like my 8th or 9th time. I've been going every year now for quite some time. I've committed myself to that, and I was really excited to take you along. I kept saying that, Jen, you have to come, you have to come, you have to be there. And because I kept thinking, like, well, how can Jen not be there? She's, you are a people person, and you like to meet people, and it's so great for networking. So I guess, and it was your, like, what were your first, I'm wondering, like, what were your overall impressions? And well, maybe you can describe, like, what was the format of the conference for people who haven't been there before?
Just for our listeners that don't know what this is, it's been going on since 1981. And it was taken over in 2000 by the farm animal rights movement, and then it changed into more of a vegan conference. So it took place this year in Virginia. It goes back and forth every year.
Washington, D.C., basically.
Yeah, so it goes between Virginia and Los Angeles. It just alternates between the two each summer, and there were about 1,500 attendees and many speakers, and there would be 5 conference rooms full of very interesting one-hour talks going on every hour. So we were always having to choose between talks that we thought would be very interesting, and it was really challenging. Sometimes I find myself going in and out of the rooms. There were a lot of animal rights celebrities there that I wanted to meet, such as Sean Monson, who created the Earthlings documentary. That is the biggest hero in my life.
And you did tell him that you've gotten so many people to see that film, right?
It's the vegan maker. It's the animal rights maker. It's the most important documentary I can possibly suggest.
You can watch it for free on YouTube. Please do.
So what you went to a different kind of a meeting one time. You went to an open discussion.
Yeah, so most of the talks, as you described, were like hour-long talks, about 45 minutes of 3 people on a panel speaking, and then about 15 minutes for questions, which has been improved in past years. But in the past, there was only 45 minutes in total. Now they're doing an hour. That's great. And then there were some talks that were called wrap sessions, which enabled the attendees to participate more. So we were able, so it was a room that was set up sort of in a semicircle type format so that we could all see each other and speak with each other. So I just attended one of these sessions. It was moderated by Gene Bauer, another animal rights hero. He's the founder of Farm Sanctuary.org, if you've never heard of it before. And he was moderating a discussion on the on ethical dilemmas of veganism. So so what the format was is that people could step up to the mic and talk about what their ethical dilemmas, because veganism isn't like, it's not a black and white thing so much when we live in a non-vegan society, right? Like, it's sometimes it's difficult, and we have to make choices, and we have to decide if we're making choices that are in line with our ethical beliefs. Mm-hmm. So most of the discussion was about this one ethical dilemma where this one person who's from Ontario, actually, she had her ethical dilemma is that there was a vegan group as part of the climate march in Ontario, Ottawa maybe, I'm not sure, and they had asked for no no non-vegan drums to be played there because people of First Nations were going to be playing vegan animal hide drums, and it grew into a big massive hate, actually, from people who started to call the organizers racists.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so anyways, in line with that, also, she started to bring up the fact that she has an ethical dilemma when people compare what happens to animals to the Jewish Holocaust, and that's an ethical dilemma as well, because some people are arguing that it actually is what a Holocaust is, and then some people of Jewish origin, but not all, as we found out from this room, take great offense to that. And so we were discussing methods of how we can approach that in our daily life and veganism. So anyways, those were some of the critical discussion points that were brought up in this hour. That hour went by really fast, by the way. It was very heated. It was really good to, I enjoyed learning from it because it was good to hear very valid and also different differing perspectives, and then to figure out where I fit in that with my own veganism. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for sure, I would say not in just that talk, but I think in all the other talks as well, I think it made people think and learn and become better at what we do as animal rights advocates.
Yeah, well, animal rights activists are generally also social justice advocates, mm-hmm. and people who tend to be quite aware of their choices in everything they do. So it's expected that you're going to have a bit of a debate on certain topics that may seem off the topic, but, mm-hmm. but really it's sort of all kind of the same thing as being respectful in how we make our, how we phrase our statements, right?
Yeah, for sure. Do you have any questions for us, Jillian?
I was going to say, what was your favorite, Jen? What was your favorite topic?
I liked going to the talks put on by the vegan medical doctors, because it's really hard to find a medical doctor, first of all, who is vegan, let alone understands the issues of veganism and nutrition in general. They don't have a lot of nutrition training in medical school. We all know this. They admit it. And one fellow in particular who is from Toronto talked about the soy myth, and he got quite upset about this one. He actually, he's very candid, and he said that the soy myth was brought about by the meat industries because soy is their number one threat. It's their number one competitor. And he said, you know, if you're ingesting soy products, you're actually reducing your cancer, your chances of getting cancer by about 15%. Wow. And there is no need to be concerned about any hormone issues, which is the scare that a lot of people have. And I think you were mentioning to me before the show that when you first heard that myth, you stopped consuming soy products. I did the same thing when I heard that myth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a really effective myth if it was the meat industries that put that out there, because I hear that so much from people, especially from the athletic men in my life who are concerned about hormone issues.
I just read online yesterday that if you are concerned about estrogens and hormones, then stop drinking cow's milk because that's what's full of them.
Exactly. I'm glad you ended this discussion with a very, very interesting fact, and thank you for that.
Yeah, so for anyone who's interested in attending the Animal Rights Conference next year, Farm will be announcing the dates within the next month, they said, and you can expect it to be on the West Coast.
And it's about $200 to go, and you can get really good deals on hotels. Allison and I shared a Hilton hotel room, which was fabulous, with four people. We paid $25 a night.
And I only paid $120 actually to register, because it's cheaper at the earlier you register. So look for that in January.
Yeah, definitely come. Whether you're vegan, an activist, or not even vegan yet, you will all get something out of this, and it will change your life.
So we have an interview that you want to intro, Jen?
Oh, yes. We're going to be speaking with photojournalist Joanne MacArthur on her new book, Captive. And Joanne was actually in attendance at the National Animal Rights Conference and displaying this book that she has. And the book that she did before that was called We Animals. So what Joanne does is she goes into factory farm situations, circuses, and zoos, and she documents with her camera what she sees. And these images that she gets are so moving. She actually puts them up for use by activists or anybody else who wants to have them for free on her website. And so let's talk about her new book, Captive, now. Welcome, Joanne. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Can you tell our listeners how you got into this line of work?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Animal rights photojournalism, it's a really it's a unique form of career path. But, you know, it didn't start that way. I started first and foremost as a photographer. I was always really compelled to taking images and storytelling. And as many photographers know, the camera is a way of satisfying our curiosity about people and things around the world. And but it changed because I always had a passion for animals and a concern for animals, and I realized that the stories of the invisible animals, as I call them, were not being told. So those in fur farms, factory farms, that kind of thing. And sometimes the animals who are in plain view, like at zoos and rodeos, were not really seeing them as individuals. And so I latched onto this idea and this story. And once I started seeing the invisible, I couldn't unsee them. I mean, they were everywhere. And so it's now, you know, 15 years, almost 17 years have passed, and I've been working on this since then. It's turned into a big body of work.
It's, you know, I was just looking at your images last night, and for our audience, obviously this is a radio show, so they can't see what we're talking about, but in your most recent book called Captive, it's animals that are languishing in zoos and aquariums around the world, and the emotions that I felt from your images is sadness, helplessness, and absolute rage at the people in those images that you see taking selfies of themselves in front of these animals that are stuck behind glass walls, and just, they're just so thoughtless. It just made me feel so helpless, and I'm so grateful for you doing this kind of work, because I don't know of anyone else who's doing it. Just how do you deal with that emotionally when you're there? I mean, you're around these people. I would be filled with rage and want to say something to them, but of course you can't. So how do you feel?
Well, it's really hard work, whether it's, you know, undercover at a fur farm or factory farm, or whether it's, you know, buying a ticket and going into a zoo. It's really confronting, it's really upsetting, and you do sort of, you know, a lot of us would sort of feel overcome with a paralysis or a deep resentment and upset that would stop us from going forward, and that, I think that's what everyone's really curious about with me. But I put my anger and my upset into action by every day doing something about it. And so I'm there with my camera, and that's my skill. And taking pictures that I know are going to educate the world. A lot of people are seeing these images, and I would love to quit doing this terrible work and seeing these things that I don't want to see. But I think, you know, I know we need to engage in these things so that we can make the world a better place for animals and for the environment. And so that's what I do. And that's what I encourage people. I speak at school quite a bit and with youth, and I always say, find out, you know, what you love doing and what you're really good at doing, and then use that to make the world a better place. And if I can just add one more thing here, because I mentioned, you know, buying a ticket to go into a zoo or a rodeo, and for a long time, I didn't want to do that. I was very conflicted about giving these businesses my money. But as Rob Laidlaw at ZooCheck said to me once, he said, actually, it's a very good investment in animal rights. And he's really right about that. You know, $20 for a ticket is not going to make or break a business. And yet it's going to provide images that thousands and even millions of people will see. So that eased my mind about that quite a bit.
Yeah, I would say that you are the one person at that facility that day during that time period that's taking images for a very different reason, and definitely the $20 ticket is so worth that, especially since you put your images online for people to use for free.
I do, yeah. And about what you said, you know, me and, you know, hundreds of other people being there taking images, it's interesting because we're all in some ways standing there in a row taking the same picture. And so it is a challenge to find a way to take the picture in a way that is different from the others. What I'm often trying to do is not show just the animal, the boredom, the despondency. I'm trying to show our interaction and lack of interaction with the animals. And so you see a lot of images that include humans in the new book.
I think that was really useful, and that really made me think, who's to blame for this? I think that's the message that I get from those. So let's talk about your first book, We Animals, for our audience members who may have missed your last show with us, where you did talk about that.
Yeah, so We Animals, where to begin? I mean, I guess We Animals is a book and a project about all of these invisible animals. You know, we do multimedia. We Animals is now a humane education program. It's speaking engagements. It's all sorts of things. But But I did a book of the invisible animals because it's just one more way to get the stories out there. It's strategic as well. You know, when you aren't just taking pictures and putting it, you know, out there in the regular channels, but if you do a book, then it just sort of adds to your career and your credibility and, you know, opens more doors. And so there are a lot of reasons to do books, but one of them is to, you know, establish myself as an author and a photojournalist, and that opens doors to, for example, the people or the businesses that are publishing my work now, like Washington Post, National Geographic, and sort of the more work you do in a professional way, the more speaking engagements there are, and the farther you reach, the more audience, the more people you reach.
Well, your books are very unique, and I know they're a hit amongst animal rights activists. I've seen your books on the tables of charitable organizations at animal rights events. And besides having your book purchased for the purpose of education by these organizations, I wonder what kind of people your book tends to appeal to, and I hope it would be purchased by people who may not be vegans or animal rights activists. Do you have any idea who your general audience is who's buying your book?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's mainly the animal rights people and the vegans who are buying the book, and that's okay. For me, it comes back to what we were just talking about, how, you know, a book does a lot of other things than simply being bought and put on someone's coffee table. I mean, these are really, really tough subject matters that I'm shooting, and, you know, I can totally understand that people would not want a coffee table book of horrible things, you know, so I realize it's not the kind of book that a lot of people want, but I see that the work and, you know, the book has historical value. What I'm doing is making these contributions in book form that I hope will, you know, be seen as historical. These will be documents of things that, you know, once were and should never be again. That's what I want these images to be ultimately.
Mm.
And so again, I mean, the book serves many purposes. So, you know, with We Animals, I think we sold 7,000 or so books, which is pretty good considering the content and how harsh it is. But again, it's about so much more than just selling the book.
I was wondering how many you sold. That's interesting. So what was the public's response to We Animals that you've heard?
Oh, well, there's a lot of response, and a lot of it is noise. You know, there are a lot of naysayers. There are a lot of people who say, you know, I'm exaggerating and my pictures are being one-sided, and those are common responses, and that's fine. That's just noise. What I do see is a lot of positive response and a lot of sharing of images, not just on social media, but through organizations who are contacting me every single day to use my images in their campaigns and websites and protests and academia. So, you know, I think the work is doing what it needs to do, and I know that there's an audience for it because I hear from these people every single day. And in fact, I, you know, have always, for years now, been overwhelmed with requests for images. So I made an archive. I built the We Animals Archive. That's weanimalsarchive.org. And right now there are over 6,000 images that people can search for using keywords and basically download high-res to use for their animal advocacy work.
Yeah, I'm really appreciative that you're doing that. Thank you so much. And I know that my friends have been using your images, and we have one on our website today of Kiska, the whale, the lone whale living in a tank in isolation. Last time we had you on the show, you were fundraising to publish your second book, Captive, and I was happy to see this book at the Animal Rights National Conference in Virginia last week on a table. Can you tell us a bit about how this book differs from We Animals?
Sure. Where We Animals is about all sorts of animals that we use and abuse for entertainment and profit, this book called Captive is specifically about the animals who are kept in zoos and aquaria. The book happened because, you know, first of all, I had over a decade of archival material and that I wanted to do something with. But then the Born Free Foundation asked me if I would work with them on a EU zoo inquiry. And so I spent 2 months photographing zoos and aquaria across Europe last year. It was extremely tedious and hot and depressing. But you know, I found myself with a huge body of work. And I thought, okay, well, now's the time for another book specifically on this topic, because the it's timely because the question of ethics of zoos and aquaria is very much in the mainstream. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone knows about the death of Harambe. A lot of people know that Marius the giraffe in Copenhagen was culled, quote unquote, because he was surplus, genetic surplus. And and blackfish and marine land and all sorts of things. So I thought, okay, I want to contribute to this conversation. And so that's why we did a book quite quickly. And really, really, really happy that the book so far has been covered by National Geographic Voices, by the Washington Post, Toronto Star, The Guardian. So it's really doing what I meant for it to do. And it's funny, back to selling books. I mean, I don't know how many people yet are going to buy this book. It's a really depressing book. And yet, you know, even if we can say we only sell 2,000 or 3,000 copies, that's okay. It's already done its job.
Yeah, I think it's a tool, really. I like the idea of people actually putting it on their coffee tables, even if somebody looks through the first few pages and they find it too sad to continue. A conversation just got started, and if I had people in my life who went to zoos and they came over for dinner, I would absolutely put that out on the table strategically.
Yeah, and I mean, like you said, they might look through a few pages, and they may not want to see more, but they've now seen that, you know, there's an entire book dedicated to this kind of thing. And there are many. And of course, mine's not just the only one. Mm-hmm. And, it's just about getting this stuff out. And whether it's on people's coffee tables, which thankfully a lot of people do, they put their Wee Animals and Cats book out on the coffee table. But, out again to The Guardian and National Geographic, it's my small contribution to this big movement and this growing conversation.
I'm so grateful for that. So what projects are you currently working on?
Well, definitely Captive right now. Captive, now is the time to be talking about Captive, and that will go until about October. And I'm doing book touring, and in the fall in Canada, and I guess I should say North America, that's my time for speaking at universities, schools, and VegFest. And then I have this wonderful project with a bunch of collaborators now. It's called Unbound. I may have mentioned that on the last time we spoke. And Unbound is about women on the front lines of animal advocacy, both historical and contemporary, because women have always been the main builders and movers in the animal rights movement. And so we're celebrating that. Quite often we see men at the top of an organization or men getting more of the attention than the women. Meanwhile, 60-80% of organizations have 60-80% made up of women. And so I have been photographing and writing about women around the world, and so has my co-author, Carrie Cronin. We have more photographers now, more writers, and it's celebratory, and it's about trailblazing, it's about problem solving, and it's about inspiring people to become animal rights lawyers, open sanctuaries, become writers, all the different things that we can do to help animals.
That's fantastic. And where do you see yourself in your career decades from now, Joanne?
There's no time to think about that, really. But when I do think about it, I know that I will be doing a lot less investigative work because it's extremely taxing work from all the travels, but the high stress, high adrenaline, high upset of it all, going into factory farms, sneaking in, sneaking into fur farms and this kind of thing. It's horrible and it's draining and it definitely has a shelf life. So I'll be doing less of that, but I imagine I will be doing a lot more speaking and a lot more writing, but also continuing to mentor other people to do this work. And that's a big part of what I do now as well. It's, we need more and more photojournalists and writers who are covering this topic of the invisible animals. And, there are a lot of people out there who photograph wildlife, a lot of people who photograph companion animals. These are all very easy animals to look at because we appreciate them for, many reasons. But then there's the invisible, and they're suffering by the billions at our hands every single year. And so we need more people going into farms or doing all sorts of creative work around exposing how they live and die. And so I mentor people, and I anticipate doing a heck of a lot more of that in the future.
I look forward to that. And I came to one of your talks at the Animal Rights National Conference and actually did take some of your advice and use it the very next day. You said, don't just post every photo you take up on social media. Pick the best one and take it very strategically and edit the colors and then put it out there. And I was one of those people that would just upload almost everything I took from a visit to a farm sanctuary. And I went to a farm sanctuary the next day and I got a really great picture. And it was because of your advice that I made sure I waited until there was no one in the background. And, you know, I got the right coloring and it's now my Facebook profile picture if you want to check it out.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that.
So that was good advice.
There's nothing I love more than talking about photography and improving our photography, and it's really a lot of fun, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
Now you know yourself, like, the better you get at it, the more pleasure you get out of it as well.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you offering tips to your audience. I didn't know that was something that you were going to be talking about during your speech, but it was good, and I'm not very techy, so I look forward to more mentorship from you. If you're ever in Vancouver doing a talk, I would love to be there for that.
Oh, well, I'm actually planning to be in D.C. for the month of March. So, yeah, it's part of speaking tours and promoting the Captive book. So I hope to be there again soon.
That's great. I look forward to seeing you again.
You too, Jen. Thanks so much.
And thank you for making time today. I know you're very busy. You're going off to Farm Sanctuary to photograph their hoedown, did you say?
Yeah, every year I go and just help contribute, with photography and also have a lot of fun. It's, you know, hundreds of activists getting together celebrating sanctuary and change and togetherness. So
we need that. We really need that. And I like that you're going to be photographing the celebration amongst activists and the support that they give one another. Those will make for some really interesting photos, I think.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing them. Well, thanks for making time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we'll talk to you soon. Have a great trip, Joanne.
Okay, you too. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that was an interview with award-winning and widely published Canadian photojournalist Joanne MacArthur talking about her work exposing animal cruelty and neglect in zoos, aquariums, and farms around the globe. You can find her work at joannemacarthur.com, and you can also have access to her images for free. They are very helpful for use in animal advocacy work and really touching, moving images. Please check those out.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
On Friday, August 25th at 7 p.m., Professor John Gluck, former primate scientist, will be giving a talk on his recent memoir, Voracious Science and the Vulnerable Animals, A Primate Scientist's Ethical Journey. Doors open at 7 and lecture begins at 7:30. After the lecture, there will be a Q&A session, followed by book signing for those who wish to either purchase the book or get a personal copy signed. There will also be an opportunity to talk with people from host organizations, the BC Foundation for Non-Animal Research, and the Animals in Science Policy Institute. On August 26th, the world will come together through March's demos to share awareness of speciesism. In Vancouver, a special demonstration will be happening at the Vancouver Art Gallery at 12 p.m. Taking place on September 2nd on the Downtown East Side, What Gives? There will be the second day of giving. This started as organizers as response to Canada 150 celebrations. Organizers are giving out basic necessities, a vegan meal, and toiletries. Organizers are asking for donations of new travel-sized toiletries, shampoo, conditioner, shower gel, soap, razors, gently used bras, juice boxes, combs, dog and cat food, and of course, other donations are welcome as well. On September 28th to October 13th, the Vancouver International Film Festival is happening.
I'm really excited about that. It is the only thing that makes the sadness of summer ending okay. I look forward to this all year round. So I'm sure everyone in the studio today has seen Racing Extinction.
I haven't, and I'm totally looking forward to that.
So I haven't yet, so it's going to be epic.
I saw it at 2015 Film Fest, and it's a documentary featuring Lalani Munter, a vegan race car driver. She actually spoke at the Animal Rights Conference about population and how it affects the environment, and she was pleading with people not to have babies. So what she did in this documentary is she mounted a giant film projector on top of her car and drove it around the streets of New York at night, projecting images of endangered species onto well-known buildings, drawing attention to the anthropogenic mass extinction of species. And if you look for this online, you'll be able to find it for free. It's called Racing Extinction. And do check out the film fest that Jillian just announced coming up. There are often some environmental and animal rights related films that are really good.
If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And now for the news. The Chilliwack Rodeo starts tonight, and as we know, the inhumane steer wrestling and calf roping are still taking place. But the Vancouver Humane Society campaign to raise concern about these two events have received attention from the fair, and they have agreed to review the two rodeo events, including potentially canceling them for 2018. Peter Fricker said, Peter Fricker from the Vancouver Humane Society remains opposed to the rodeo in principle, but welcomes the Chilliwack Fair's willingness to at least address concerns over these highly controversial events. I'm sure every one of our listeners watched that horrific video showing a woman hitting and biting her Chinese crested type dog on a Toronto subway on August 5th. Well, the Ontario SPCA was able to obtain a warrant and remove the dog from the owner's possession. The dog is now in care of the Ontario SPCA. Toronto police have charged a 37-year-old woman with one count of causing unnecessary suffering to an animal under the Criminal Code of Canada and one count of causing distress to an animal under the Ontario SPCA Act. This just reminded me of how disconnected we are from other species, because as we all know, this is happening behind closed doors for millions of other animals, and we're letting it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Have you taken part in Health Canada's healthy eating consultations yet? You have until August 14th to share your opinions about marketing unhealthy foods and drinks to your children. Canada's Food Guide was introduced in 1942 and was specifically recommended milk and milk products to be part of a healthy diet. This is our chance for our voice to be heard and science to be listened to instead of the lobbyists for the meat and dairy industry. The BC wildfires continue to burn. You can donate. You can contact the PetSafe Coalition to see how you can help. Last week, they were looking for gift certificates for Costco and gas cards. And the mystery has been solved. 10 endangered North Atlantic right whales found dead since June 7th in the Gulf of St. Lawrence due to contact with vessels and net entanglements. The Canadian government is implementing a temporary mandatory slowdown for vessels of 20 meters or more in length to address the deaths of the North Atlantic right whales. The slowdown takes effect immediately and will remain in place until the endangered whales migrate out of the area. Vessels that don't comply will be given fines from $6,000 to $25,000.
Is that it for the news?
That's it for the news.
Okay, so next we have our feature interview. And just to open this up, what we're talking about again is the Marine Land Animal Rights charges that were, the Marine Land Animal Rights issue that's been in the news this week. So 11 animal cruelty charges against Marine Land Canada filed in the past year by Ontario Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals were dropped by the Crown Thursday morning at Provincial Offences Court in Niagara Falls. The charges related to the care of the park's black bears, elk, deer, peacocks, and guinea hens. The Crown dropped 8 of the charges because there was, quote, no reasonable prospect of conviction, and the remaining 3 were dropped because they were, quote, deemed not in the public's interest to pursue. So joining us today to discuss this issue is Anna Pippis, an animal rights lawyer, strategist, and an activist. She specializes in issues relating to farmed animals and the animal rights movement more broadly. She proudly serves as director of farmed animal advocacy for animal justice and as projects director for We Animals. She believes these two organizations do an excellent job of making animal use and abuse visible and laying the groundwork for legal and political reform, factors that she thinks are essential for our movement. Today, Anna joins us to discuss the recent court case involving Marine Land Canada. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
How many times have we had you on here now?
A lot, and it's just only getting better.
The voice of reason when we don't know what's going on in the court system. So you can you bring our listeners up to speed on Marine Land's history and what led to these recent animal cruelty complaints?
Right. Okay. So Marineland is For people who might not know, in Vancouver, Marineland is one of the only two marine parks in Canada. So there's the Vancouver Aquarium and then Marineland. These are the only two facilities that keep captive cetaceans, whales, dolphins, that kind of thing, in captivity. But Marineland is very different in tone than the Vancouver Aquarium. While the Vancouver Aquarium talks about, it sort of hides behind a bit of a veil, if you will, of conservation and education. And, you know, we can discuss and debate how true that really is. Marineland really makes no attempt to hide the fact that it's an amusement park. It has roller coaster rides, a midway. The animals perform. They're not part of any breeding program. It really is a circus. And in fact, I mean, literally a circus. The owner, John Hohler, who's quite notorious, used to be a circus person. So really, it's very much an outdated way of thinking about and using animals. John Hohler himself is from another era. He's in his 70s and a real character. I've met him and I've sat with him in court proceedings against him, and he's just, you know, he's an ill-tempered person, not the type of person who you would really want to entrust vulnerable animals to his care. So that's my two cents on the matter. He's also been very litigious on behalf of Marineland, going after activists for speaking out against the cruelty that's taking place in the facility. I think he's filed lawsuits against something like six activists, possibly more, and as well media outlets. So there's a lot of really bad stuff going on there. Now, bringing us to the current case, what has happened was that Last Chance for Animals, which is an animal advocacy organization, conducted an undercover investigation where they had a person go in wired with a hidden camera who it was an employment base. The person had a job there and had every right to be there behind the scenes, and they documented what took place. And they documented what is frankly largely visible to the general public, which is that the animals are emaciated, they're hungry, they're forced to interact with humans, they're starved so that they will be, so that humans can be guaranteed an up close and personal encounter. Many of the whales are living in these very chlorinated pools and suffering from skin problems. LCA documented an incident of one of the whale calves being isolated by accident, apparently, and then this baby being isolated from his or her mother for 3 months. So there's just a lot of really bad neglect and abuse taking place there. And many people for many years have been filing complaints with authorities and criticizing the facility and trying to get changes. And it's worth noting here that the law enforcement body in the region is the Niagara Falls Humane Society. And John Hohler has been such a big donor to them that he has a plaque on the wall of their facility thanking him for his support. So lots and lots and lots of problems. Now, after Last Chance for Animals investigation, we all were really, really happy to see that the OSPCA, which is who enforces the animal protection laws in the province, did file 11 animal cruelty charges. This was precedent setting. This was a major victory in the fight, in the decades-long fight against Marineland. We were all really glad to see that things really did appear to be finally changing. So yes, it was an absolute blow when the Crown prosecutors then in turn decided not to proceed on those 11 counts, which is their right to do, but I think it's very unfortunate.
Well, can you help us understand why such blatant animal cruelty was dismissed by the courts?
I can try, but to be honest, I'm having a hard time understanding it myself. It is hard to understand, and it's incredibly disappointing. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I can look at Last Chance for Animals' legal complaint and their evidence, and I can sort of surmise, I think, what the Crown was up to. So typically what happens is prosecutors will... We don't always prosecute crimes. I mean, there's lots of sort of petty or minor crimes that are taking place, or legal violations that are taking place, I mean, constantly on a daily basis. Like, many of us might even be breaking laws when we're jaywalking, or, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. But, of course, not every single legal violation results in a prosecution. So there actually is quite a big discretionary area for prosecutors to decide when they're going to proceed. So on the eight counts where they said there's not a reasonable chance of conviction, that's one of the two things they'll look to. They'll look at reasonable chance of conviction and in the public interest, which are the two tests that they sort of want to pass before they proceed. Now, reasonable chance of conviction, essentially what they're saying is, all right, you've got this footage of animals with skin problems, but can we really prove this was a skin problem? There wasn't a veterinarian present to actually look at it in person and to confirm it. The animal is no longer there, or the issue is no longer there, or whatever else is going on. So, you know, we're not able to essentially prove this in the way that the court requires us to. So that's what they're saying. You know, whether or not that's true, I don't know. Again, it's hard to speak too authoritatively without having looked at the file and considered what's going on. But it does smell a bit fishy, I must say. Now, on the second, the much more disturbing is the three counts that they dismissed because it's not in the public interest to pursue. So what they said is, well, yeah, we might be able to get a conviction on these counts, these animal cruelty charges, but it would be really expensive, and we just don't think it's worthwhile. We just don't think it's essentially serious enough is basically the subtext there. And I think this is incredibly problematic because it basically gives a free pass to people to neglect and abuse animals because they don't matter anyway. You know, the animal cruelty laws aren't going to be enforced because, you know, the prosecutor's office just doesn't care, essentially. So, you know, this is a really, really big problem. I think it's undemocratic. I think it's the wrong decision. You know, this one, on this one, I can say with certainty, I mean, we're prosecuting minor dumb things all the time. So sure, we can consider expense. But, you know, keep in mind, Anita Crimes was recently prosecuted at great expense to the public on a multi-day trial for giving water to a thirsty pig. So, you know, it's not uncommon that we're prosecuting things that are ridiculous, and certainly animal cruelty is not something that most of us think is ridiculous. It's also not just about the animals who are suffering on those counts, but it's about serving a deterrent effect. If you say to Marineland, you cannot harm and abuse animals, going forward, that's going to change their practices. Conversely, if you say to them, which they did, it's not really serious enough, they're just going to continue to do what they're doing. So we're going to see much more broad systemic problems. I mean, if the issue is many animals are suffering, but we don't have serious evidence, well, you try to get them where you can. You know, it's like with the mafia. You can't get the mafia on tax evasion, but you get them on, I mean, I'm sorry, you can't get them on murder, but you get them on tax evasion. It's like everyone knows there's these murders, but we can't prove them. So you just go after them however you can. And that's what they should do with Marineland. If they've got some sort of animal cruelty case against Marineland, everyone knows animal cruelty is happening at Marineland. Let's prosecute them. It has to happen. So that's my opinion on the matter, but that's not what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not very knowledgeable in our legal system, so can you tell us what the next step could be here?
Well, I think the next step is we need to be forward thinking. It's unlikely that this decision will be reversed. So what, you know, we really need to make lemonade. We need to publicize this and point to it as a legal shortcoming. We need to say Marineland is allowed to abuse and neglect animals. Existing laws aren't working. We need to see changes. So I'm not sure if people have seen yet today, but Animal Justice released an investigation into a zoo in Ontario. So zoos and aquatic parks are very, very similar. And the investigation, of course, as they always do, shows heartbreaking animal cruelty, because when animals are used for profit, there's always suffering taking place behind closed doors. And so what we're asking for is, you know, two things. One is, first of all, in the short term, we need these facilities to be regulated. They're not regulated. What does that mean? Well, that means anyone can open up one of these facilities with no training, with no particular equipment or skills or expertise or training or competency, and they can run these facilities with no oversight. So they can essentially, it's the Wild West. They can do what they want. So, you know, number one is, in the immediate term, this needs to be regulated in Ontario yesterday. In the longer term, of course, we need to have a bigger conversation about the ethics of keeping these animals in captivity. We know, because scientists tell us, that we simply cannot meet the needs of animals like cetaceans, but perhaps all animals, because the whole point of a zoo is to guarantee, or an aquarium, is to guarantee people an up-and-close encounter. But, you know, what about the animals' needs for privacy? What about their need to have long-ranging habitats as they would in the wild? What about their need and desire to have freedom and family and choice in who they spend their time with, just like all of us would prefer? You know, you can go to a zoo or to an aquarium and you can see the animals and it might all seem fine, but just put yourself in their shoes. Would you like to be confined to a small enclosure where people are staring at you all day? You have no freedom, no choice in who you spend your time with, no ability to, you know, realize your natural, normal life. And on top of that, we have to consider what lesson this is teaching to children. I mean, of course, I'm a mother, and so I come at everything from the perspective of a mother, because that's my lens through which I see the world. But I think it's the wrong message to send to kids. Like, of course my children would love to go and see animals up close. But, like, what child wouldn't, right? But it sends them the wrong message. They're too young to understand, so we have to be their guides. We have to teach them that we are not above the natural world, that we are part of the natural world. And I think it's this thinking that we can do whatever we want, exploit and pillage and destroy and ruin the natural world all for our own trivial, fleeting interests. This is the wrong message in so, so many ways. We need to teach our children how to be ambassadors of the natural world, how to respect it, how to live within it and live within our sort of environmental means.
Well, this case reminds me of the Vancouver Aquarium suing filmmaker Gary Charbonneau, who created the documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. So can you explain what a slap suit is and how they are used to silence the truth from advocates of justice, which is exactly what happened in this case with Marineland as well?
Yes, exactly. So slap suit, SLAP is an acronym, and it's short for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. So what that means is essentially some typically powerful, wealthy party uses the legal system to bully activists into, you know, not participating in activism. So, you know, McDonald's will sue somebody, protesters, or it's usually suing protesters and activists, but some large an oil and gas company, or yes, in this case, Marineland has done this, and certainly Vancouver Aquarium as well. They'll use the legal system to try to silence critics, people who are undertaking, you know, something in the social good on their volunteer time, on their own time, are, you know, suddenly facing a lawsuit from a party that has the ability to afford lawyers and sort of like endless legal proceedings, which can be very frightening and expensive. And it has a major deterring effect on people speaking out against practices that are wrong. And it has a major chilling effect. Even if you don't think these practices are wrong, we all have an interest in free speech. We all have an interest in public dialogue and debate being open. And so what we need to, what needs to happen is we need to have federal legislation essentially banning slap lawsuits. And there's been some really good scholarship into how something that sort of complex might be done. It's doable and it needs to happen because, you know, whether you care about animals or whether you care about democracy, we really, really need to preserve free speech and allow people to be activists without fear that they're going to be persecuted or bullied by some powerful party. And I would say, I think that's really the commonality with how Marineland has conducted itself in the face of criticism, and the same thing with the Vancouver Aquarium. They didn't like Gary's documentary, and so they misused intellectual property law to try to get it removed from the internet by saying it was a copyright violation. Well, copyright violation, what does that have to do with anything? Their entire legal proceedings are filled with talking about, I mean, essentially making a defamation case for themselves. I'm starting to get a bit technical here, which I'm sure is probably over most people's heads.
I'm finding it interesting. I would like you to carry on about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I mean, basically what happened was they filed a lawsuit for intellectual property because that's what would have allowed them to get the documentary removed from sites like YouTube and Vimeo, right? Because if you've got a copyright violation, those sites will take a video down. So they didn't say the video is, you know, untrue. They said, well, that's our footage. And it was photographs taken by animal rights photographers that they were saying that they owned, but they said, well, we own it because it was taken at our facility. I mean, that would be like if somebody went to Italy and took a photo of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and then Italy said, oh, that's, we have copyright over that because we own the Leaning Tower of Pisa, so your photo is our photo. It is ludicrous. I mean, that is just not how our copyright laws work. So the fact that Vancouver Aquarium was making this bogus argument, I think, goes to show how disingenuous their claim was. In reality, what they... And then their copyright claim was filled with things like, this is not true, this is not fair. Well, those are defamation arguments. What you're saying is you don't like the content of the documentary. And a defamation lawsuit, a content lawsuit, wouldn't have been enough to get a documentary taken down off of Vimeo. Because if you said to, you know, Vimeo or YouTube, well, this is defamatory, they're going to say, great, you know, show me the legal ruling that says this, which they wouldn't have been able to do. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to show, I mean, I think that they're not being honest when they're saying, you know, when they're filing their lawsuit.
Right. Well, thanks for all that clarification regarding the Vancouver Aquarium. And a lot of people don't know that.
A little technical, but.
Well, no, I thought it was really interesting. And we've had you on the show before, so now you're sort of expanding on other topics that we've had on that issue with a little more depth. And I think everyone can understand what you just said. And a lot of people don't know that the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland have been tied together business-wise. So maybe if you're able to speak about that a little bit. I know that Phil Demers, who is one of the whistleblowers from Marineland, was actually featured in the Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered documentary talking about how the sea lions that got sent there from Vancouver Aquarium, their skin was coming off and they went blind because the ozone purification system broke, and rather than fixing it, they just dumped too much chlorine in the pools, and that was how that affected the animals. So I do put the blame on the aquarium for sending their animals to a facility that wasn't being properly run.
I mean, of course. And this is sort of a much broader problem with these facilities, is they're trading back and forth the animals all the time, which, you know, is going to be causing stress to the animals, and also just goes to show that they're all sort of one and the same. I mean, Vancouver Aquarium is trading, and Marineland and, you know, SeaWorld, they're all trading animals with each other back and forth, and part of it is sometimes it's for breeding, sometimes it's just for entertainment value, whatever it is that's going on. You pull at a thread and the entire tapestry unravels. They're all really related. And on top of that, they're all sort of part of this so-called regulatory oversight body, CASA, the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which really is an industry friend group. I mean, all of the people, if you look at the executives and the board members, actually this is revealed very well in Gary Charbonneau's documentary, Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. I mean, this is not an independent third-party government body. This is created of industry executives so that they can regulate themselves, which is a common response to industries that want to be unregulated. Animals in research, farmed animals, they're all industry regulated in a way that is, you know, very much reminiscent of the fox guarding the hen house.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's easy to feel powerless when we see what should have been an easy victory this week turn into a failed attempt to obtain justice for animals. So can you offer any advice for how concerned citizens who are not lawyers can have a meaningful impact on the lives of animals languishing in zoos and aquaria?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's important to keep looking forward and to see this setback as an opportunity to have a dialogue, because we all have a really important role to play. Our laws don't change until we the public, demand them to change. So, I mean, you know, it's not going to just be a handful of lawyers. It's going to be all of us together as a movement, and every little thing that we all do, it all works together to create, you know, the movement and the uprising that we really need. So continue to have these conversations. Go to Animal Justice, sign the petition getting Ontario to regulate zoos and aquariums. Share our investigation that we released today and talk to people about the problem. Not only that they should be regulated, but that ultimately, should they even exist at all? Because that's what's going to end all of this. Now, we can only do so much with swaying public opinion, because the reality is that there are always going to be a few people who just don't get on board with some kind of social idea. And you can look at social justice movements throughout history to see, like, well, you can't just convince everyone that, you know, holding slaves is wrong. You can't just convince anyone that women are not the property of men. You can't just convince everyone that LGBT people are people too. You have to then translate that growing momentum into laws, because there are some people who just will never be reached by education and outreach. And for those people, we need to drag them kicking and screaming into the modern era with legislation. And in order to get legislation, you need to create a political bloc that is powerful, just the way that animal use industries have done. We need to be equally powerful. That means we need to be loud, we need to be cooperative, we need to be getting political, talking to politicians, emailing them. When I get off the phone with you, I'm going to email Vancouver City Council, because I see that a municipality has just banned the sale of hamsters and reptiles in addition to cats and dogs, and I'm going to tell them, hey, you just banned cats and dogs, why don't you do this too? That needs to be a part of everyone's daily life. And I know, Jen, that is something that you're already doing, and everyone who cares about animals needs to make correspondence and meetings with politicians part of their activism.
Thank you, Anna. You speak so powerfully. You're such an inspiration. And I just want to let everyone know who is maybe not aware of who Anna Pippis is. She is also a mother to two kids, so she makes time for this. And I often hear the excuse, I don't have time for speaking up for animals. I have a family to look after. I think that people with children have a greater responsibility, even if you don't mind me saying, to create a better world for them. So if there's something very small that an animal rights activist is asking you to do, please don't make an excuse. Just make a little bit of time. And we try to make it easy when we have a request for you. We try to have a petition that's already got all the write up on it, and we're going to take care of sending that to the authorities. All you have to do is take 30 seconds and fill it out. These things really do make a difference. And so, Anna, with your two young children who you're raising to be animal rights activists, you bring them to public demonstrations such as the March to Close All Slaughterhouses and protests where animals are exploited, such as the Vancouver Aquarium. What do you want to say to people who take their families to zoos and aquariums with all the silly excuses they give, like, well, it's educational and we don't know what else to do on a rainy day or whatever?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think people, I think I sort of touched on this earlier, but I think people really need to consider what kind of lesson is this teaching our kids. Our kids are too young to understand broader cultural and political things that are at play. All they see is animal, cool. But when they grow up, they're going to understand, you know, we're going to be teaching them, is it okay to exploit and pillage the earth, or is it not okay? And, you know, there's really only, I think, one answer that's going to keep us on track to not make ourselves extinct through climate change, which is that we need to get back in touch with the fact that we are part of an ecosystem, and we have to respect and be considerate of the fact that we share this world with many other species, and that the world is finite, and that there's only so much we can take and take and take from the world. And you speak about busyness, and I would just say to that, I think when people say they're too busy, what they really mean is they don't have the emotional energy to turn their mind to something. And to them, I would say, I hear you, it's hard, but I would invite you to step up to the plate and be the person who, be somebody who lives in alignment with your values. None of us want to see, you know, the earth be lost to climate change. None of us want to see animals suffering. And so it takes a little bit of a mental shift and saying, yes, I am going to care about this. I am going to be somebody who cares deeply, because, you know, what else is life for if not to be able to give back?
Well, thank you, Annie. We're just out of time now, so I just want to quickly give a plug to you. You work for Animal Justice. People can find information about your organization at animaljustice.ca. And is there any thought you want to leave us with before we go here?
No, definitely check out animaljustice.ca, sign the petition, follow our work, and support legal and political reform for animals, because it's a key part of the puzzle, support many organizations, but including ours.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Anna Pippis from Animal Justice. She is a Vancouver-based animal rights lawyer and a vegan. And thanks for being on the show, Anna. I will talk to you soon. And you've been listening to Animal Voices Radio on Co-op Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Tune in again next Friday at noon for our show. We here at Animal Voices Radio want to hear from you. Find us on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver, including already updated all of the events and news that we announced today, if you wanted to find more information on those. On our website at animalvoices.org, Twitter, Animal Voices YVR, email, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, and stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock next. And remember to be kind to the animals. We're going to be leaving you today with a song by The Revivalists called Wish I Knew You, and I am dedicating this to all the animal rights activists who I wish I knew sooner in my life. I love you all.